It's good to see you this morning in the house of the Lord, and I'm glad to be with you. This is the first Sunday morning of August. I think you're aware of that. And the last couple of years, I've been taking this Sunday to do a Vision Sunday, to talk to you about I think that maybe the direction of the church should be in the coming months. And I decided that what I wanted to do was to preach to you this morning about the kind of church we want to leave to our children. And I wanted to talk to folks who are between, say, 25 and 55, somewhere in there, and talk to us specifically about the kind of church that we ought to be building and leaving for our kids, because that's what we're doing. I mean, that's sort of, we're in that age where we need to build a spiritual legacy for our families. And so that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to talk about how, you know, you leave a financial legacy, you're concerned about perhaps their education, you're concerned about many things, but we ought to be concerned about leaving them a spiritual legacy. But then it crossed my mind that I'm not sure that everybody would be there, because there's a presupposition with that, and that is that you have to believe the church is important and that leaving a spiritual legacy is important. And so it's one thing to say, how are we going to leave our children a church that will sustain them? But before you get there, you have to believe that the church is important to begin with. And so I want to talk to you about why I believe in the church today. And I want to try to drive that into your thinking about why I believe the church is still important. Now, usually when you preach in your home church, you feel like you're preaching to a home crowd. You believe that at least 90% of the people probably agree with you. It ought to feel like Neyland Stadium when you're winning. They don't get to experience that much, but when they're winning, but next year's going to be different. Next year's going to be different. Next year, we got a quarterback, so next year's going to be different. But I'm not so sure this is going to be a home crowd sermon. As I've thought about it, I don't know that half of you agree with what I'm about to say. But I want to drive home into your thinking that this church and you being in this room on a Sunday morning is of vital importance. Now, the church is facing extremely difficult days in America. And if you are not aware of that, there's something broken in your radar. Now, we talked about this some on Sunday night, so be new material for most of you. But generally speaking, in the last 40 years, if you go back to 1980, generally speaking, about 40% of Americans were in church on a Sunday morning. And that was a pretty consistent number from like 1950 to 1980. And people kept saying 4 out of 10 people go to church in America, but about 20 years ago, they started looking at those numbers and they start to say, no, that's not true. Because if you ask somebody if they were in church on Sunday morning, 40% will lie to you. So it's more like 25%. But then you have the latest numbers coming out in 2020, and they say there's 350,000 to 380,000 churches in America, and the average church is 65 people. So you do the math. That's like 27, 28 million people. We have 330 million legal people in America, plus some others. That's 8%. So now you're talking about in a 40-year period, The average number of Americans worshiping on a Sunday morning has gone from 40% to potentially 8% of the population. That's an 80% drop in 40 years. You are living through the greatest spiritual recession this country has ever had. And the problem is, when something, if you own a stock and it falls 80%, you sort of figure you're near the bottom. There's no reason to believe it we're near the bottom. Because most of the people in churches are over the age of 60. And secondly, we're about to have a major pastoral shortage. So in the next 20 years or so, when everybody who's going to be in heaven in 20 years makes it to heaven, and half the churches don't have pastors, you're not going to hold where we are now. It's going under 5%, if it's around 10%. It's a devastating time in the life of the church. And it can be very frustrating when people are still arguing about the color of the carpet. It's like, no, let's put the chair there. Let's put the chair in there. We're on the bloody Titanic, people. Quit arguing about the chairs. Quit arguing about what the band played. The boat's going down. And you don't argue about the carpet. I'm just saying that because we got to replace carpet in a couple years. I'm getting out ahead of it. And you say, well, what's going on in the church in America? And you could argue that, I mean, you could make a case that that list is pretty long. You don't have a potentially 70 to 80% decline in a generation without there being a lot of problems. But I tend to think that probably at the top of that list is that you have massive consumerism in America, and then the church was willing to accommodate the consumerism. And not everything you eat or feed, not everything you feed will eat you, but consumerism is one of the things that will actually eat you. Because if you feed consumerism, it gets to the point where you can't satisfy it any longer. And so America has become extremely consumeristic. It is really our great drug. And the church was willing to feed the consumerism. So now we're at a point where it doesn't matter what we do. It's not entertaining enough. And we are an entertainment-driven, comfort-driven culture. And the church can no longer meet the demands that are set on it. And the church is to blame for trying to do that to begin with. But we thought that's what we had to do. And this started back in the 40s and 50s when we started padding the pews and doing the air con. I mean, some of you grew up in churches where they didn't pad the pews and they opened the windows in the summertime, and you sit there with your kids on the pew. They didn't have children's programs really at a Sunday school. But then over 80 years, we've continued to feed the animal until we can no longer satisfy it. No longer satisfy. I mean, if you want to understand how soft and consumeristic America is today, one word for you, mattresses. I was talking to my mom. So somebody about my age said, hey, I wonder where our parents went to buy mattresses. I'm going somewhere with this. I don't know. I asked my mom, where'd you buy your mattress? Because they had this same mattress for 30 years. In fact, it's still in the basement. They got married and bought the mattress. It's still down there. That's 60 years old. They just kept the mattress. She said, I don't remember where we bought the mattress. Because I'm just saying, when I drive around, there's 10 stores that sell nothing but mattresses. 40 years ago, I don't know. I guess you went to Sears. Where did you buy a mattress at? Now, you can make a 10 stores can stay in business in a town like ours just selling mattresses. That's how comfort-driven we are. Half the world is out there and, you know, they're carrying about, and you know, you go two generations before us. This is all of human history was caring about. Let's see. Safety, clean water, food, just having food, just having basic health care so you don't die of stuff that there's a cure for, like smallpox, just food, water, safety, not getting shot at, not in a war, and then maybe shelter, sanitation, because if you didn't take care of your sanitation, that bred diseases. Sanitation, then, I mean, the big one, refrigeration, but that's not in the top five, but refrigerating, being able to refrigerate your food, heat in your house, that would be a big one, but that wouldn't be the top five. Transportation, maybe education, but education would be like number 10 on the list. I mean, but most of the world in history has been consumed with like those things, and half the world is, and here we are consumed with lumbar support when we sleep. That's where we're at. We're not on the top 10 list. We're down to like number 70. I got to get my number right. I got to get, you know, I got to get a bed that's got the right number with my pillow. That's what we're concerned about. We're first world, baby. We will quit a church if the pew's not comfortable enough. So that's where we're at. And that's what we're concerned about. And again, the church has largely tried to accommodate, but the animal we have fed is now eating us. We can't feed it anymore. And so that's where we're at. And so then, I mean, hey, you talk about the pastoral. You may not know this, but the Church of God, there's about 2,000 Churches of God in America. And we've had one seminary, one place to go get your master's if you wanted to pastor. I went there. When I was there, there was about 80 students. That was 15, 16 years ago. Maybe 18. Holy cow. 18 years ago. And then it grew after I left. It had like 150 students. Right now, 2,000 churches. We have 10 to 15, and this counts online students, 10 to 15 students in our seminary. There are no pastors coming out of Anderson, out of the seminary. Some are coming out of undergrad. And so, again, you have those issues, but then you got the streaming thing, right? That's not getting better because now it's too hard to get to church. I got to watch it in my Tempur Postopedic or whatever you call it with my right number, with my two, my pillows right there in my jammies. So that's what consumerism does. Deliver it. Uber my religion. It's too hard to get there. You need to deliver it. And so, again, this is where we're at. There's a church in this town. I won't name names. But they're part of a denomination that when I came, they were a thriving church. But this denomination publishes numbers. This church has 1,061 members. There's 1,061 people in this county who go to this church in this town. And it's a big church. Last year they published their numbers. Their average attendance was 88. On a membership of 1,000 in a building. Listen, that's where we are in America. That's the church in America. So, again, I was going to preach and say, hey, what kind of church are we going to leave our kids? And I think that's based on the presupposition that you care whether you leave your kids a church or not. And I don't know that that's a done deal. But, again, let me move quickly. We need to care about the church. You ought to come to church not because it's got a good-looking preacher. Or good singing, or nice pews, or air conditioning, or a great band, or a great children's program, or a youth program, or whatever else we got, whatever else you're looking for. But you ought to come to church. You ought to care about the church first of all, because Jesus Christ cared about the church. Jesus cared about the church. If you're a believer, actually that's all you need to hear. Jesus cared about the church. Luke chapter 4:16 says that on the Sabbath day, he went to the synagogue as was his custom. Jesus Christ went to church on the Sabbath. Now you say, why did Jesus have to go to church? And think about the poor, miserable rabbi trying to preach while Jesus is sitting on the pew. That's got to really stink. You know, I talk about intimidation. But Jesus went to church. Now, why did Jesus go to church? Well, it was his custom. Because in the Ten Commandments, it said honor the Sabbath. He couldn't have not honored the Sabbath if he hadn't gone to church. But see, there's even something else there. Because when you look at Exodus chapter 20, it talks about the Sabbath. But then in Deuteronomy chapter 5, and then later on in the Old Testament, it will frequently talk about the sign of the Sabbath. See, the Sabbath, when you go to church, when you come here on Sunday morning, it's a sign, the Bible says, of your covenant with God. The Bible will talk about it as a sign of the covenant. What that means is that every time you show up, you get up, you go to church, you're saying, God, we still got a relationship. And then Deuteronomy chapter 5 says you ought to honor the Sabbath because you were slaves and you got delivered. So not only am I coming as a sign of saying, God, I still love you, I'm still with you, there's still a relationship here, but you're also coming, Jesus, or the Bible said, as a sign of thanksgiving. You were delivered, you've been cleansed, you've been brought out like the Egyptians, and so I'm just coming to tell you again, I'm thankful for what you're doing in my life. So Jesus honored that. It was a way, it was a sign that he's still in relationship with the Father, the sign of the covenant. And then when he starts his ministry, he doesn't just come to save, he just doesn't come to heal, but he starts with 12 and he builds a community. So all through this time, he's building a church. And then you have the day of Pentecost. There's 120 on the day of Pentecost. And it says that 3,000 were added to that number, and they were all together in one accord, in one place, breaking bread together, going from house to house, sharing in the faith. And God added to the number such as were being saved. That's Acts chapter 2, 42 through 46. So that then the Spirit that came on Pentecost, his job is to also build a church. God came to build a church. It mattered to him. And if nothing else means anything to you, if it mattered to Jesus, it ought to matter to you. Say, I don't like the church. Well, fake it if Jesus matters to you. I mean, you love your kids. You fake liking stuff because you like your kids. I'm not going to tell the kid that. I mean, if the kid likes it, you root for it. You care about it. You want to be part of it. And that's part of what love is. What matters to you matters to me because I love you. Jesus loves the church. Acts 20:28 says that he bought the church with his blood. You know, John 3:16 will say he died for the whole world. But then even the Bible zeroes it in and says he shed his blood to build a church. That was the goal there, to build a body of believers. So it matters to Jesus. Secondly, the church matters to the nation. It matters to the nation. God will save a nation if he can find enough people who care enough to be faithful to him and to build a church. God will save a nation for a righteous remnant. He was willing to save Sodom and Gomorrah if he could find 10 righteous people who cared, who were coming together, who were living righteous lives. It matters. You know, in Europe in the 18th century, and we mentioned this before, but one of the great questions of history is why did France collapse and England not in the 18th century? Because they were essentially equal in so many ways. They both had economic decline. Both were on the verge of bankruptcy. Both had very low morale because in France you had the starvation riots, and famously, you know, Marie Antoinette, when they said they don't have bread, she said, let them eat cake. You know, Marie Antoinette. Awful woman to be married to right there. But in any case, beside the point. But then you had England, and England had massive debt because of the wars. the big war was against us. And then you had very, very low morale because neither king was very good. And again, you had low morals because in France, I mean, we have a problem if our leaders have affairs. I mean, France, they had open mistresses. The king had Versailles there and multiple mistresses. And then in England, you had the slave trade was in full swing. So the morals of the people, I mean, the people were just living terribly. And then the state of the church was terrible because in France, you had the Catholic Church, which was dead. And in England, you had the Church of England, which was dead. So low morals, no religious fervor, low morale, on the verge of bankruptcy. France goes right into a full-blown collapse. Finally, Napoleon comes along and sort of begins to salvage the country for a time. But England survived. You know, why did England survive when France collapsed? And Woodrow Wilson, who was our president and a great historian before he became president, said that it was because of John Wesley. John Wesley was a preacher anointed by the Spirit who began to preach. And he was ultimately the father of the Methodist Church, although he didn't want to start a church. He wanted to reform the Church of England, and that happened after he died. But he began to build cottage churches. He began to build groups of people throughout the land that really did care about what God wanted for them. And Woodrow Wilson said that was enough salt. It was enough salt to keep England from spoiling. It wasn't a lot. You don't have to have a lot of light in the middle of darkness. It was enough light. It was enough salt that the founders or the pre-runners of the Methodist movement saved a nation by just being enough salt that they kept it from going into a full-blown collapse. That's the power of a church. That's the power of the church in America. Doesn't take everybody, but if enough people will be faithful, if enough people will be committed, if enough people will do right, if enough people will still say, what matters to Jesus matters to us, you can save a nation on the verge of collapse. It's been done before. If you care about the nation, you ought to care about the church. Part of my patriotism or part of the outgrowth of my patriotism is an investment in the church. Because I think the church is the greatest hope for a nation. Third, you ought to care about the church for the sake of your children. We'll get into more of that next week, so I won't belabor that. But your children need a spiritual home. When prodigals leave, and let's face it, most of our children will end up as prodigals at some point in our life. I want to believe all my kids will be right and that they'll never leave and that they'll give their hearts to the Lord early on. And I'm praying for that. I'm working for that. That's what I want. But let's face it. Many of our children have a season of being a prodigal in their life. There needs to be a home for them to come back to. I mean, you can think about the prodigal son in the far country. And what would have happened if they just sold the house and moved off? There had been no place for him to come back to. You need to maintain a home, a spiritual home for your children to come back to. And it needs to be a vibrant home. Your children need a spiritual family. I didn't fully realize this entirely until Dad went to be with the Lord. But you can say, well, here's my physical family, and we're in it together, and we're doing life together, and we're going to lean on each other as a family. But you know what? Sometimes a storm hits the whole family. And there's only so much comfort you can give each other when you're all in the storm. I mean, that's the principle of Celebrate Recovery. If you're trying to recover from addiction, don't find somebody who's in the middle of the same addiction. Find somebody who had the addiction and who is now doing better. Don't find somebody with the same problem in the same storm. Find somebody who's 3 or 4 years out of the storm. That's who you need. And I didn't realize that until I had my own situation there. My family was great, but the comfort I received in that moment of my life came from brothers and sisters in the faith that had been through that storm but weren't there now. See, my family was, we were all in that together. So the comfort there was more limited than you would think from the surface. But it was those people that my father had put in my life. Those uncles in the faith, Uncle Ralph and Uncle Tony, Uncle Gary. I mean, it was actually in that season of my life, it was the people of my dad's age that ministered to me that provided the most comfort. They were the ones saying, hey, listen, if you can't pull yourself together, don't worry about it. We'll all come down and we'll pastor your church for 3 months. We'll help you. Don't worry about it. We're going to carry you. Don't worry about it. You're going to be fine. We're going to put you on our shoulders. We're going to take you there. Don't worry about it. I mean, that's where the comfort. I mean, I'm not saying my family didn't provide any comfort, but again, we were all in the bloody storm together. Nobody had a life vest. We were all drowning. And you need that. You need that. I want my children, and I have to be very intentional about this, because I won't always be there. And one of the questions I ask myself is, who will minister to my kids when I'm not there? Or maybe when I'm not able to. Who's going to minister to my kids when they hate me? They don't want to talk to me. Well, They got Uncle Thomas and Uncle Brian and Uncle Buck, and they got a lot of uncles, man, they can go to. They got some mothers in the faith. They got some aunts in the faith. They don't have to come to me. I know 20 people who will tell them the truth. Just go see your spiritual uncles. Go see. Now, you know, you say, I'm going to put them in a good youth group. Yeah, that's good, but understand that those are like the spiritual cousins. Those could be part of the problem. Get them connected to your generation, because you don't know what's happening at their generation. But if you build the relationships with people of your age and connect your children to them, now you're talking about some reinforcements. Now you're talking. Your children need the church. They do. Where are they coming back to if they walk away from the Lord? And listen, you and I are teaching them where to run when life collapses on them. We're teaching them. And there might be somebody here, and you don't realize it, but you're teaching your child that the answer to life's problems is alcohol, because when you have a bad day, you come home, you pour a little alcohol, you sit down on the couch, and you drink a couple. And you're teaching your kid that's how you deal with stress in life. You use alcohol, and maybe you don't go as far as others, but you have no idea what your kid's going to do. Some of you are teaching your children that the way you deal with stress, the way you deal with problems, is with nicotine. Some of you are teaching them that the way you deal with stress is with a credit card, because when you get really sad, man, you take that plastic down there and you blow it up. Well, you're teaching your kid. Why don't you teach your kid that the way you deal with stress and the way you deal with problems is you go to Jesus and you go to the house of God. That's how you deal with it. So your children need the church. It's important to Jesus. It's important to the nation. It's important to your families. And you know what? It's important to you. It's important to me. There's a way in which God speaks to us when two or three are gathered together that won't happen when you're by yourself. There's a way that God speaks when His people are together. There's a way in which He ministers that you don't get alone. I've been in a lot of powerful services in my life, and not that they have CDs anymore. You know, when I was in a really powerful service, a lot of times I would buy the CD and I'd give it to a friend, or I'd listen to it later. You know what happens when you're in a powerful service and the Lord is moving and people are shouting and people are getting saved? And you know what happens when you plug the CD in? The Holy Spirit's not attached to the CD. The people who got fed were in the room when it happened. You listen to the CD or you watch it, it's the equivalent of watching a great cook cook a meal on TV. You got to see it happen, but you didn't get a taste of food. The people who were in the studio audience at the time got to sample the food. You just got to watch the guy cook it, man. There's a big difference in those two things. And what you find is that when you're together, the Spirit moves. The Spirit works among you in ways that you could never replicate the next day or the next hour or even at that time outside of that building. It's completely different. You know, there's a place in Psalm 73. I'm almost finished, in case you're worried about that. It's my fourth point and my first conclusion. Psalm 73, you have Asaph, and I've preached on him a lot, and this is where I'm going to leave you today. You coming back next week? All right. Maybe it is a home crowd. Maybe. Psalm 73, Asaph begins that psalm, and he says, God is good, but verse 2, but as for me, my feet had almost stumbled. My steps had nearly slipped. He said, I almost lost my faith. And then he talks about all the injustice he sees in life and how people were getting rich and he was going broke and people were healthy and he was sick and his family was sick. And he talked about how when he looked around, everybody was doing well that wasn't living right and he was trying to live right and nothing was working right. And in verse 16, he says, when I thought how to understand this, it was too painful for me. It wasn't just painful. It was too painful, man. It's too painful. Verse 17, until I went into the sanctuary of God. So in other words, he's saying, you know, this thing had been building up and I've been watching. And I assume maybe he'd been praying and he'd been talking. I don't know what he was doing. But. At home, it was about to destroy him. He said, but the turning point in my life came when I walked into the sanctuary of God. And when he walked into the sanctuary of God, God spoke to him. Wasn't speaking to him as long as he was number 74, Tempur-Pedic, my pillow, sitting at home in bed. But when he got on his clothes and went to the sanctuary of God, God said, all right, I'm going to give you a word. God said to him, let me tell you about these people you're watching. First of all, everything they got is going to be taken from them. Verse 18, surely you have sinned. Oh, verse 17, when I went to the sanctuary, then I understood therein. Verse 18, surely you have set them in slippery places. You cast them down to destruction. So God said, listen, Asaph, you sap. What they have ain't going to last. You're envious of them over something that is going to be taken from them. And verse 19, and how they are brought in a moment brought to desolation as in a moment. They are utterly consumed with terrors. In other words, Asaph, not only is it not going to last, it's not satisfying them. They're as afraid as everybody else. You're envious of what they got, and they're scared half to death. They might lose what they have. They're scared to death, Asaph. They're utterly consumed with terrors. Verse 20, and as a dream when one awakes, so, Lord, when you awake, you'll despise their image. So God is saying, listen, it's not going to last. It doesn't satisfy. And they're bound for destruction, Asaph. They're going to be utterly consumed. And that's one of the scariest verses in the Bible because he says, as you awake from a dream, it's going to be for them when I turn against them. You know what that's like when you dream? And it's beautiful. You wake up. And there you are, laying in your filth. So it's one of the most painful realities to dream a beautiful dream and to wake up and return to your miserable life. And he says that's what eternity is going to be like for them. All that they've experienced here, someday they're dying. And they're going to wake up in eternity, and this is all going to feel like a dream. It's not going to even feel real. Reality is yet to come for them. He says, ASAP, man, you're thinking about it all wrong. These people are not to be envied. These people are bound for destruction, ASAP. Quit envying these people. The wrath of God's about to fall on them. And then God says to ASAP, but remember what I think about you. Verse 21, my heart was grieved and I was vexed in my mind. I was so foolish and ignorant. I was like a beast before you. Nevertheless, I am continually with you. In other words, he says, I was like a dog. Worse than that, I was like a cat. I was like an animal, man. But I forgot, you're with me. I've got you. They've got junk that's going to rust, and I got you. You hold me. Your right hand, you will guide me with your counsel and afterwards receive me to glory. I'm bound for glory. They're bound for destruction. And he says, whom have I in heaven but you? There's none upon earth that I desire beside you. My flesh and my heart fell, but God is the strength of my heart and my portion forever. Amen. Where did he get that? He got it when he went to church, man. When I went to the sanctuary of God, God spoke to me. It was a sign. When I go into the sanctuary, it's me saying, God, it's a sign. We're with you. I'm with you. The covenant remains. I'm thankful for what you're doing. I'm glad for being your child. I know the reality of life. Everything out there is fading, but everything I feel in here, it's eternal, and you're forever with me. And you need to hear that. You need to experience that. Church is important. It's important you being here. Stand with me. Wonder if